And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You can judge a man by how he treats the least among us. Well, the same applies to judging women, and Sarah Palin demands that we apply the same standard to her and her candidacy. In Alaska, Governor Palin has much impact on the lives of some of our nation's most unique Native peoples. So how does she treat those who ask simply to maintain their subsistence lives? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Perhaps you've heard about the DVD that is being distributed through newspapers to over 28 million people. It's a full-length documentary on the threats to America from Islamic terrorists. It's called Obsession. There are many potential threats to our way of life, and today I continue my obsession with one that I find literally in our front yard, namely, the possibility that Sarah Palin could become president of the United States. To me, this is a far more present danger to the lives of all Americans, and one that we have to take very seriously. According to authoritative actuarial tables, there is a 1-in-3 chance that Sarah Palin would become the next president if she and McCain were elected. America has always been, for me, more than just a collection of people within the boundaries of our 50 states. It is, in fact, a legacy of a march towards an option for people to decide their own destiny, based on the collective will expressed through the democratic process. And what has distinguished the American ethos is a respect for those with whom any one of us, and most importantly, the majority, may disagree. This built-in spirit of tolerance, respect, and kindness is perhaps the true expression of one nation under God that I can summon. But I am compelled to state clearly that a form of brutishness, intolerance, and arrogance has taken over our nation ever since the Bush administration took power. We have witnessed some of the most divisive and elitist rhetoric coming from the decider and the army of attack dogs that comprise and promote the Bush doctrine. This is a radical change in the character of American politics in the modern age. It is not politics as usual. Certainly politics have been ugly, mean-spirited, and often crass in the past. But now with the capability of pounding fear, contempt, and smears endlessly through highly coordinated messaging from talking heads on TV, ranting righties on radio, and blustering buffooniacs on right-wing blogs, the accumulating depth of crap is impeding the goodwill of those who live good lives as liberals or students, families, small businesses, folks, and common riffraff amongst us, who live each day with a true American moral compass that steers us towards tolerance and common decency in our dialogue. But with this election, we are now confronted with Sarah Palin, who has some agenda, although I can't think of anyone who can define it, because she blunders each time she tries to articulate it effectively herself. And with her lack of a refined sense of who Americans are, perhaps from her hanging out far too long with far too many Joe Sixpacks, God love 'em, who salute the flag with one hand while the other hand throws another empty beer can on the carpet, she blindly tosses out implications that we need to be really careful with a guy like Barack Hussein Obama, because he hangs out with terrorists. Her witless sense of judgment that would tell almost any rational American that such pitiful attempts at character assassination tend to inspire some drunken Joe Sixpack to get it over with and shoot that dirty bastard traitor. It exhibits a reckless style unbefitting anyone who even pretends to claim the right to lead this nation. Character assassination inspires assassination. Does she even lack the most elemental common sense to refrain from the mindless appellation of the subliminally seditious slander? And that is why today I continue to reveal the real Sarah Palin, focusing on her legacy towards the native peoples of her native state. As you will hear, these people whose literal survival depends on the recent judgment of any governor of Alaska find Sarah Palin's worldview blind to the subtleties of balance between people and their environment as they ask for their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So now, and continuing in segment two of today's show, we talk with attorney Lloyd Miller, who is a native rights attorney and partner in the Alaska law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Sashi, Anderson, and Perry.
Much of my work has involved litigating matters between tribes in Alaska, outside Alaska, and the United States government. And to some extent, the litigation has also involved tribes resolving disputes with state governments. I've had cases that unfortunately have to go all the way to the Supreme Court, but fortunately we've prevailed, and the cases in many of the courts of appeals around the country.
And how long have you been focused in this particular area yourself?
My entire career, since I left law school and finished a clerkship in 1979.
I guess what I'd like to investigate first of all, how her governorship and potential presidency ultimately, since you've been involved in Native issues for a long time, I'd like to discuss the issues and the trends and how they've developed over that time. Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? What are the major issues?
American Indian policy really has vacillated over the last century and a half. It has gone from a tradition of seeking to assimilate, if not eliminate, Native American people from the national scene to policies of separation and reservation life, to an era that really began in the early 1970s, in which we still find ourselves, and that's the tribal self-determination era, or the Indian self-determination era. This has been really an enlightened policy that was brought about by tremendous tribal advocacy during the civil rights years of the 1960s. Congress responded with the Indian Self-Determination Act and with the Indian Civil Rights Act and a number of other statutes designed to strengthen tribal governments, to get tribal governments out from under the yoke of federal oppression, to get tribes out from under the thumb of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is an agency within the U.S. Department of the Interior, and to permit the tribes to reclaim their original sovereignty and to strengthen it. Now, over this long arc of time, these last 30 years, Congress has adhered pretty closely to that tradition and has acted in the areas of law enforcement, tribal courts, infrastructure, and other areas to do what it can to remove the obstacles that stand in the way of tribes being able to take over greater control over their own communities and their own futures. Sometimes this movement has been rapid, and sometimes it hasn't been, but I would say that it hasn't changed course. In the last 8 years, there's been very little movement forward in terms of tribal self-determination policy from the federal government. The president has certainly shown no interest, much less leadership, in this area. And Congress, as a result, and of course as a result of the distraction of other national and international matters, has likewise not devoted substantial energy in this area. And I think many of us who work with Indian tribes, who advocate for tribes, wonder whether the next administration will signal a new beginning, more of the same, or backtracking. Of course, we won't know till the election is over, but it becomes a very important election for Native American people as they look for some change from the policies that have prevailed over the last 8 years.
Historically, the issue about Native American sovereignty and identity and dignity and self-determination is very complex, but there must be some major themes that run throughout that probably are the areas of struggle and where you're finding the most need to focus. Historically, leading up to this last 8 years, what may some of those main themes have been?
Well, I think one of the greatest difficulties has been in law enforcement and related issues of jurisdiction in Indian communities. Much of the problem in this area has been born of Supreme Court decisions. The United States Supreme Court has issued rulings in various cases that have had the effect of dismantling the ability of tribes to coherently govern their own communities by instead requiring that tribes behave differently depending on the race or membership of individuals they encounter as potential criminal defendants, by requiring that tribes behave differently depending on land ownership within their communities, really fractionating tribal sovereignty in a way that is completely incoherent, makes no sense, is something that would never be visited upon a local city government or state government, but is something that the Supreme Court has saddled tribes with and has produced a tremendous loss of control locally. Now, Congress could, by my measure, Congress should respond to these decisions by enacting legislation that in this area overturns those Supreme Court decisions and rights the ship. Congress has the authority to do that under the Constitution in this area, and in fact it has exercised that power in the past, but not over the last 8 years. And nobody for a moment thinks that any corrective legislation would be able to pass without a very supportive president and a supportive Congress.
And I always hesitate to talk on behalf of Native Americans because, first of all, it's an extremely diverse group of people stretching throughout all of the Americas. So that being said, I will generalize and say this. From my perspective, there does seem to be a very unique relationship, very profound relationship, generally speaking, between people and their land. It's the grounding of who they are. And again, I'm generalizing because in some cases that's not so much the case. But I think traditionally that has been where some of the rubber meets the road in terms of these definitions and the trends. And that to me is an extremely important aspect as it relates to Native Americans, Native people, and indigenous people in Alaska, specifically where some of these villages and towns and peoples go back thousands of years and are struggling now to maintain their way or to identify their way or restore their way as it relates to their land. But now you have the added influence of encroachment and policies that begin to dramatically impact that way of life. Can you give us a sense of how that's playing out in Alaska?
I can. I think your remarks are very profound and insightful. Someone who comes to Village Alaska for the first time, who is familiar with Native American communities outside Alaska, would find something striking, and that is that the Native people on the coast of Alaska and along the villages, by and large, still speak their own language, to varying extents, still live a way of life that's based on the seasons, a subsistence way of life, we call it, based on hunting and fishing, gathering, and teaching generations through those activities, teaching values through those activities. They are communities that are as indigenous and aboriginal as one could imagine within the United States. And yet, the irony of it is that although in many places, in most places in Alaska, this is the case, the village tribes in Alaska lack the recognized authority over their lands that the Sioux tribes have, that the Navajo Nation has, that tribes elsewhere in the United States have. And it is because the United States Congress took a different approach to Alaska Native affairs than it took vis-a-vis other Native American peoples. The approach the Congress took, which was embedded in the statute adopted in 1971, reflected a unique combination of pressures between the state of Alaska, the oil companies, the United States, and the Alaska Native tribes that had laid claim at that time to most of the state and whose claims were barring the development of the oil fields on the North Slope. The unique settlement that Congress achieved at that time, called a settlement but imposed upon the tribes, dispossessed the land from the people and put the land instead into Alaska Native corporations. The corporations were to have members who were Alaska Native people, so each tribe's members would become shareholders of a corporation, and the corporation would then be free to develop the lands under various provisions of state and special corporate law. But the people who lived in the communities no longer had a right to walk on their own lands as tribal land. Instead, these lands now belonged to a corporation. Worse than that, Congress terminated and extinguished all native hunting and fishing rights. And in doing this, Congress said that it expected that the state of Alaska and the Secretary of the Interior would take cooperative action to put into place measures that would assure that Native people would continue being able to hunt and fish as they had for generations, for millennia. Turned out that did not happen. And not surprising, I think, if one looks at the experience in any other place in America. State governments are generally not friendly to Native American hunting and fishing rights, and much more often than not combat those rights, seek to extract as much of those resources for the benefit of the non-Native population. And Alaska proved to be no different. After a few years of a failed effort to secure hunting and fishing rights for Native people, Congress actually had to come back in and rescue the situation and enact a new statute that recreated, if you will, hunting and fishing rights in rural Alaska. But it's been a real struggle, and it is for this reason. These combined forces, the tremendous tie that Native people in Alaska in particular have to the land, because the land sustains them, literally sustains them, that hunting and fishing rights in Alaska are so vitally important.
That adds an extraordinary dimension that I was completely unaware of. I did not know that, in essence, the rights to the land had been stripped from the original owners. That really complicates the matter. I can't even imagine how you work your way through that legally. But that has direct implications in terms of the, we'll kind of bring this into the Palin governorship, because that has been a huge part of her legacy as governor, impacting virtually almost every aspect of life in Alaska. Can you give us a sense of who she is and how she kind of sees the world is affecting Native Americans in these issues?
Like the story about the blind people who are touching the elephant trying to figure out what it is, I only see Governor Palin through this narrow lens of Native American issues. I can't really give you a sense of the whole person. I wouldn't try to. But any governor in Alaska will have tremendous responsibility in areas of hunting and fishing rights. And the reason for this takes a little bit of explaining, but then you'll see what I mean. When Congress passed this legislation that restored hunting and fishing rights, it restored them under a very unique regime. And it requires remembering what our Constitution says Congress can and cannot do to understand. Congress regulates activities on federal lands. Congress does not regulate activities on state land, but fish and game don't know boundaries. So fish go up rivers through state and federal lands, and caribou herds migrate across state and federal lands, and for that matter, Native corporate lands also. How do you get a single regime in place that covers Native rights to hunt and fish on all lands, because they live in a patchwork area of state, federal, and Native corporate lands? Congress passed a piece of legislation that established a priority for subsistence hunting and fishing activities in all federal waters and federal lands. And then it told the state, if you will adopt an identical program for your state lands, we will turn over management of the federal lands to you, the state. And the state, in fact, accepted that offer and carried out a program, albeit one that was frequently challenged as being far too weak, for a few years. And then in the early 1990s, the state Supreme Court ruled that the state's action under this federal legislation actually violated the state constitution. As a result of that, the federal government came in and started managing subsistence hunting and fishing rights on federal lands and waters. Today, we now have a dual system where the state of Alaska regulates hunting and fishing on state lands, including Native corporate lands, which is a bit ironic since it's somewhat hostile to Native rights and yet is regulating hunting and fishing on Native lands.
They regulate and manage those rights.
But since the Alaska Native villagers engage in much hunting and fishing on federal lands and in federal waters, the federal government protects hunting and fishing there. So you have a dual system. In that setting, the governor for the state of Alaska has the ability to do two things, to react to the federal regime and to control the state regime. When it comes to the federal regime, the administration under Governor Palin carrying over from positions taken by her prior administration, the Murkowski administration, has leveled a broadside attack on the entire federal regime and sought to dismantle it. That is a direct attack on native hunting and fishing rights, primarily fishing rights, on federal waters and federal lands. On the state side, she has tolerated people on the state board that are openly racist, including one individual who chaired the board who accused people who were coming to testify at hearings as being more interested in buying beer than testifying. I mean, really outrageous, openly racist remarks. So in my experience, which is just a narrow slice, I find that the Palin administration has been, in the area of hunting and fishing rights, particularly hostile to Native interests. Now, having said that, I don't think it's motivated out of animus to Native people. Well, I am in no position to say. I think what it's motivated by is a desire to maximize the amount of fish and game available for sport hunters and sport fishers, and as well as a commercial fishery. Here the issue is not so much whether more fishing or less fishing should occur overall, whether more hunting or less hunting should occur overall vis-a-vis particular herds of particular stocks. Mm-hmm. It's who should take the numbers that have been designated by the biologists as appropriate to take without damaging the herd.
I appreciate that perspective.
And the economic interests in the state of Alaska are the economic interests behind the sport hunters and the commercial fishermen and sport fishermen. It is not the native people on the ground. Well, I think it's the economic powers that dictate what happens to fish and game in our state. And the native people come last. The native people who live in the villages, who depend upon fish and game, only prevail to the extent they do because they have federal regime in place for federal lands and waters, and because there still are some state laws in place that give at least some preference for native rural subsistence users. But it has become so diluted compared to the federal regime that it really has little resemblance to it. Again, the reason is very clear. There aren't enough fish and game to satisfy all needs. And the state has chosen, in various means, both by attacking the federal system and by altering its own system, to maximize the amount that's allocated to the sport and commercial sectors, even if that comes at the price of the native and rural subsistence users. And that's plain as day.
And then, of course, we have Sarah Palin's lofty thoughts on aerial hunting of wolves and bear. We focus our sights on this and more when your voice of the earth returns, here on the Wild Side News.
Way up north,
up to Alaska.
Way up north,
up to Alaska.
North to Alaska, go north for Russia's own.
North
to Alaska, go north for Russia's own. Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92
with George Pratt, his partner, and brother Billy, too. They crossed the Yukon River and found the Bonanza Gold
below that old white mountain just a little southeast of Nome. Sam crossed the majestic mountains to the valleys far below.
He talked to his team of Huskies as he mushed on through the snow, with the northern lights a-running wild in the land of the midnight sun.
Yes, Sam McCord was a mighty man in the year of 1901. Where the river is winding, big nuggets they're finding.
North
to Alaska, we're going north, the rush is on.
Way up north.
Way up north.